From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Golda Meir said there wasn't such a place as Palestine. It was regarded as the empty land. And when I read that, it reminded me of my own country, Australia, which was, when it was colonized by the British, they called it terra nullius, empty land. It's a colonial thing. You know, when the indigenous people get in the way, then you either have got to try and slaughter them, as was happened in the United States and other, or in Latin America, or you've got to declare them invisible.
Today, the hidden agendas of U.S. foreign policy. An interview with investigative journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. Named Journalist of the Year twice in Britain, his latest book, The New Rulers of the World. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A student with neo-Nazi ties tried to assassinate French President Jacques Chirac in Paris Sunday during Bastille Day celebrations. He fired at the president's motorcade with a hunting rifle, but missed. A Pakistani judge has convicted four people in the kidnapping and slaying of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. The judge sentenced the British-born chief defendant to death and the others to 25 years in prison. Before the verdict, the defense lawyer claimed the prosecution had offered no substantive evidence against his clients and said he expected an acquittal, quote, unless the verdict is influenced by the government of Pakistan and the government of the United States of America. Hundreds of protesters joined by national civil rights activists Friday gathered at Inglewood, California, police headquarters to demand the arrest of the white officer shown punching a handcuffed black teenager on videotape. A second officer has admitted punching him as well. The man who filmed the beating has been arrested on outstanding warrants. The policeman, Jeremy Morse, remains free. 27 Hindus were massacred in Kashmir over the weekend. India immediately blamed Pakistan for the attacks. The victims were poor residents of a Hindu slum. They were killed by gunmen posing as priests. In the United States, Congress members of both parties are calling on the Securities Exchange Commission Chair Harvey Pitt to resign. They say his previous work for big accounting firms and corporations as a private securities lawyer creates too much potential for a conflict of interest. Appearing on CBS Face the Nation Sunday, Pitt said he's the right person for the job and, quote, this guilt by occupation is really a needless diversion. Meanwhile, it's emerged the man President Bush tapped to lead his corporate crime watchdog team was a director of a San Francisco credit card firm that just 2 years ago paid more than $400 million to settle charges of unfair and deceptive business practices. He's Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, who served on the board of directors of Providian Financial Corp. At the same time, regulators found the firm systematically charged excessive fees and used deceptive sales tactics to bolster its bottom line. The evidence that President Bush was involved in insider trading while he was on the board of directors at Harkin Energy is growing. The nonpartisan Center for Public Integrity has released a confidential Harkin document, which shows the company sent President Bush a report on projected earnings over 2 weeks before he sold some $850,000 worth of stock. A White House official said Bush believed the company was going to lose about $9 million that quarter. Newly released WorldCom documents show WorldCom workers believed as early as March 2000 that the company was moving around money on its internal books to make the company look more profitable than it was. WorldCom senior financial managers ordered low-level workers to record transactions on its books that the workers viewed as improper. The documents also show in at least one case the workers raised those concerns with auditor Arthur Anderson. A former Anderson official in charge of the WorldCom account repeatedly denied his firm had ever been told about efforts to reclassify regular expenses as capital investments. The New York Times is reporting the Halliburton company is profiting directly from the Bush administration's so-called war on terror. Halliburton is the Dallas Energy Services giant that's being investigated by the SEC for its accounting practices when Vice President Dick Cheney ran the company. The Bush administration's wars have led to significant additional business for a unit of Halliburton called KBR. KBR built cells for prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and has been a new contract to provide logistical support for U.S. troops in Uzbekistan. The 10-year contract is shrouded in secrecy and has no lid on costs. Army contract managers estimate KBR's work in Central Asia will cost 10 to 20% more than if military personnel were used. KBR recently paid $2 million to settle charges that it inflated prices. Preparations are continuing for an attack on Iraq. Some 300 Iraqi opposition, military, and political leaders convened an unprecedented conference in London over the weekend to discuss options for toppling Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. They warned Sunday a large-scale invasion would bring widespread destruction without removing Saddam Hussein and would not be supported by opponents of the current regime. The delegates said large-scale Western attacks on Iraq will be unnecessary because most Iraqi forces will turn against Saddam Hussein at the outbreak of hostilities. Meanwhile, senior British defense officials have informed the government British troops will have to be stationed in Iraq for up to 5 years as part of an occupation force once Saddam Hussein has been removed from power. The occupation would be to prevent the post-Saddam state from fragmenting into civil war and anarchy. One staffer in the office of California Democratic Congressmember Henry Waxman told the London Observer, "It's certainly strange that the more the finance scandals approach the White House, the harder and sharper the plans for an attack on Iraq." This news from Nigeria: unarmed village women in the Niger Delta are continuing to hold more than 500 Chevron Texaco workers inside an oil terminal as part of a week-long protest for jobs and electricity. And Mexico's government began freeing about a dozen jailed farmers who were protesting plans to construct a new multi-million-dollar international airport outside Mexico City. The protests began Thursday with street battles between police and protesters in which 30 people were injured. Since then, hundreds of farmers armed with sticks, knives, and machetes have kept police at bay. Protesters have taken some hostages. They say they will not be released until all jailed farmers are set free.
President Bush does not want to jeopardize the profits of industries that pollute the environment.
What a sales pitch there.
Are you mad enough to wrestle the most beautiful girl in the world?
I came here for New York. I want to go back.
President Bush touched down in Los Angeles tonight with not much to say.
What I would suggest is to use the imagination.
Children in the United States don't read enough and they watch too much television.
Get those screens up. Fire all paper. Fire all paper.
Anyone with a reliable, affordable car anymore?
So I bought a 44 Magnum with solid steel.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I think it's very appropriate to be talking about the issues we will, especially around Palestine in Native America. Native America and Native Americans know well what it means to be rounded up and put on reservations, Bantustan-like areas. We're joined by John Pilger, who's just returned from the occupied territories, from the West Bank and Gaza. He is one of the world's most renowned journalists, has done many films, written many books. His latest is called The New Rulers of the World. He also has a film by that title. He's done films on Iraq, Paying the Price, on East Timor, Death of a Nation, a number of films on Cambodia, including Year Zero. All have been very important, and a number of them have, well, in this country, in the United States, I would just outright say censored. It'll be interesting to hear what John says about trying to get his groundbreaking reporting, for which he's known all over the world, into the United States. That seems to be more difficult than exposing the stories he does and getting into the locked doors he gets behind, doing the important work. But getting the word out, well, it's a different story here. John Pilger, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Well, why don't we start where you just left, and that is the occupied territories. It's certainly not the first time you've been there. You were there a quarter of a century ago, did a film, and back again now.
Yeah.
Talk about what you saw.
Okay. Well, I've been reporting from the Middle East for many years. I started going there in the 60s, and I made a film there in the 1970s called Palestine is Still the Issue. And it was really about the expulsion of Palestinians from their land, and the military occupation, which was then in force following the 1967 war. The film I've just made is going to have the same title, because it is still the issue. You don't get that impression reading so much of the press, especially in this country, I have to say, or watching the issue reported on television. Often the roles of victim and oppressor are reversed. But the issue in that part of the world, as it was brought home vividly and often tragically to me recently, was the military occupation of 22% of Palestine. I mean, there, you almost have to go back to a kind of basic understanding. Israel occupies, the state of Israel occupies something like 78% of original Palestine. The Palestinians accept that. 22% are the occupied territories in Gaza, and Israel occupies that 22%. That's the issue. And within that, there are huge tragedies on both sides. But it was brought home to me in a series of interviews with people, both in Israel and in the occupied territories, that until that issue, that basic issue of the occupation, is addressed, and that the Palestinians have a homeland, nothing will change. The suicide bombing will go on, the outrages will go on, nothing will change.
Can you talk about the father of one of the victims of a suicide bombing?
You see, there are voices in Israel that are very seldom heard in the mainstream. There's some extraordinary Israelis that understand what the issue really is, not simply the issue as propaganda. I interviewed a wonderful man, his name is Rami, whose 14-year-old daughter went out shopping one day in Ben Yehudim Street, a busy shopping street in Jerusalem, and a suicide bomber appeared, and Shmada is her name, was killed, was blown up. It's that loss that goes to the heart. I have a daughter her age, actually, so that connection was made between the two of us immediately. But instead of, I suppose, as most people would do and understandably, then disappearing into this terrible pit of grief and mourning, which they have done, of course, very close family, he's looked at the reasons, the political reasons, that contributed to his daughter's death. And he's convinced that the occupation is a contribution to that. And he very much opposes it and has helped to form a group called, I think it's called, the Family Circle, of parents who have lost children or relatives in suicide bomb attacks, who've joined up incredibly as much they can in the occupied territories with the parents of the suicide bombers themselves, in order to make some sense of why these outrages, these atrocities have happened, and how they can stop.
There's so many places to go with you, both on Palestine and also how you connect these issues up. In your book, The New Rulers of the World, you take on a number of different forces that are shaping the world today. Can you talk about the new rulers of the world?
Yeah. Well, the title is something of a misnomer, because they're the old rulers, really. The people who've been ruling the world are those who have, who control most of the world's resources and wealth. I mean, that's been true since Columbus's day. The world is controlled by, I suppose, an elite of about 1 billion people, most of whom live in the so-called northern countries, the United States, Europe, Japan, elsewhere, and most of humanity have almost none of the wealth that we have, we in the developed countries. So those who run the rich parts of the world are its rulers, and this has come down, of course, to the main ruler, which of course is the United States, now that it is the lone superpower. What has changed is the power of finance capital. Finance capital, when it was released about 15, 20 years ago, allowed the growth of multinational corporations as never before. I mean, we've always had huge entities, huge like IBM and you name it. The great capitalists, invented the multinational corporation. But now we have a group of multinational corporations with, for example, Motorola has greater wealth than Nigeria. Ford is bigger than South Africa. They're bigger than countries. This is not to suggest, as some of those in the anti-globalization movement have, that the state has disappeared and that the world is now being led by these multinational corporations. Not at all. The something, you know, $500 odd billion in the U.S. of U.S. state money goes to hidden subsidies of great capital companies and entities. They wouldn't exist without state subsidy. The arms business wouldn't exist without state subsidy. Agribusiness wouldn't exist without state subsidy. So this fusion of state and these great corporations have made up those who rule the world. And the new, I suppose, it's a new face in many ways, a new face of the rulers of the world, but they're the same forces.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Iraq, have spent time, you made a film about Iraq, paying the price. You have pinpointed the group in the United States around Paul Wolfowitz who are pushing to once again bomb Iraq. Mm. Can you talk about this new attack?
Well, yes, and you see, the attack on Iraq has absolutely nothing to do with the propaganda. It has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. government knows that Iraq has been, probably more than any government in the world, has been disarmed, has had inspectors crawl all over it. If it does have a few chemical weapons left, they're minor compared with the kind of weapons that exist elsewhere in the Middle East, such as in Israel. The real reason for the what seems to be the coming attack on Iraq is that Iraq is the second greatest source of oil in the world, and its oil is the best quality oil. What the U.S. wants is another thug running it, but one who is more compliant than the present thug. And it comes down very simply to that. Saddam Hussein was the probably the closest ally that the United States has had in the post-war years. More weapons, more trade, chemical ingredients for chemical weapons all went to Saddam Hussein. It was known in Washington as the love affair between the Reagan administration and the George Bush senior administration. We have on the record in Congress the just how much the previous Bush administration broke the law, broke an embargo which was then imposed on Iraq in order to get weapons and a trade through to Saddam Hussein. In other words, he was more than just a client. He was so important. He was a centerpiece because the U.S. saw him as a counterpoint to Iran, which was the real problem for the U.S. in that part of the world. The problem with Saddam Hussein is with some clients is that he started to do things that weren't approved. And his invasion of Kuwait was not approved, although there is evidence now that it wasn't disapproved as well. The Pentagon told Clinton 4 years ago that there was the real possibility of 10,000 civilian casualties if the U.S. attacked Iraq. I'm really not sure they're worrying too much about that, but the country may break up, which is what they don't want. There are other reasons. It's about, with so much of U.S. policy, it's about demonstrating U.S. military power at a time of great economic uncertainty, or uncertainty about U.S. economic power.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Again, we're talking with John Pilger, the great filmmaker and writer. He's here in Santa Fe for a day or two, and then headed back to Britain to finish his film on the occupied territories. But let's talk about the War on Terror, the context in which all this is taking place. You've written extensively about it. We've had you on the phone about it. Where are we today with it? I mean, in terms of those the U.S. said they were going after, who U.S. allies are, like Saudi Arabia, who Bush is in terms of his oily past.
Yeah. Well, there's great disarray in Washington on one level. On another level, U.S. foreign policy is following its usual straight line. In the Middle East, it is shoring up the pillars of U.S. foreign policy, and that is basically on Israel and Saudi Arabia, protecting those pillars. The missing pillar, or pillars, was Iran and Iraq, and that's why they're worried about Iraq. They want somebody in there who can again make it a proper American client. So that's going along a fairly straight line. But clearly there's some real disarray within the administration, because the Palestinians, whom no American administration have regarded as important, are making themselves important. They've always been a thorn in the side of real power, because they don't have anything. They're refugees, most of them. They don't have any oil. They're just a people wanting their own homeland. But they, until that is resolved, they know, the U.S. knows, there'll be great instability in that part of the world. The worry seems to be that one faction, and perhaps it's the whole administration, I don't know, I don't have any particular lines to Washington at all, but some of the fundamentalists in a very fundamentalist regime now in Washington are clearly supporting the Sharon policy, unstated, although stated by a number of his cabinet ministers and other leading figures in Israel, of getting rid of the Palestinians altogether. I mean, getting them over the Jordan, and those who are left, keeping them on kind of reservations, bantustans, as you know, in the South African model, surrounding them with compliant leaders. Certainly there seems to be a great deal of support for that in Washington.
John Pilger is author of his latest book, New Rulers of the World, has just returned from the West Bank and Gaza. I conducted this interview with him last week in Santa Fe. He's a reporter in Britain. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back with him in a minute.
What is it good for? Absolutely. Nothing. Say it again, y'all. What? to me. Oh, oh, I despise.
Edwin Starr, War, here on Democracy Now! As we return to journalist and author John Pilger, among his books, Hidden Agendas, The New Rulers of the World.
Now, how likely do you think it is that they will try to just completely expel the Palestinians?
Well, I don't think they completely expel them, but in a way, Israeli policy is also, in its own terms, failing, because they can only so many times go back and keep on surrounding Arafat's compound and surrounding refugee camps. And the Palestinians' level of pain is so high, the threshold is so high, that people that I spoke to, you know, it's a sense of nothing to lose. And the suicide bombings express that. They express nothing to lose. So Israel has, from their point of view, has to move it forward at some point. I think it's quite likely. I think that's been the history of Zionism. It has been to put down what they call settlements, take the land progressively by stealth, if you like, and get rid of the Arab population. Golda Meir said there wasn't such a place as Palestine. It was regarded as the empty land. When I read that, it reminded me of my own country, Australia, which was, when it was colonized by the British, they called it terra nullius, empty land. It's a colonial thing. You know, when the indigenous people get in the way, then you either have got to try and slaughter them, as was happened in the United States and other, or in Latin America, or you've got to declare them invisible. One or the other, because they're actually there. The Palestinians won't allow themselves to be declared invisible. And although I'm making light of it, but those racist stereotypes exist in this country, the United States, towards the Palestinians, and among the Israeli establishment.
I want to talk about how it is we haven't heard too much about your work in the United States, but I also want to go back to your homeland, which is Australia.
Yeah.
You're an expat in Britain, and the Aborigines. You've done a lot of work exposing the conditions there. Talk about them.
Mm. Well, I mean, I grew up in an Australia where, in Sydney, the biggest city, where it was almost impossible to see an Aborigine. There's so few of them. Only 2% of the population. There was a reservation not far from where I lived. Where I, as a child, I remember crawl across the sand dunes and look at these strange black people. Who, it was said, actually lived there for tens of thousands of years. The view then was that they were dying off, though no one could explain how they could just die off. Well, in fact, they were being killed off, they were with diseases that even today Australia is on a World Health Organization shame list of countries that have not conquered trachoma, the thing. It's a biblical disease. It's in the Bible that makes people blind. It's the only Western developed country that still has trachoma among its people. Even countries like Sri Lanka have beaten it. And you go into Western Australia and there are blind people, blind children, because of this disease. And it's a disease of poverty. It's about dust kicking into your eyes. It's about not having available running water and that kind of thing. It's a disease of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to, like many Australians, I left for Europe. And I was sent back by my newspaper. I then began working for a British newspaper, and I was sent back to actually report on the Aborigines in my own country. And then I made trips into the outback, into this extraordinary part of the world, the oldest physical landscape on Earth, where the oldest continuous group of humanity lives. There's no question about it. These are the oldest people. And, you know, I was stunned to find these people who were my own country. So I've made many films on them, and I made the first film I made in a book I wrote called The Secret Country, because it was had been secret to me and had been secret to my compatriots. And the Aborigines and their supporters, white supporters, have made big strides. But whereas other countries, including this country, the United States, where there has been, begrudgingly, belatedly, a recognition of the entity of indigenous peoples, Canada, US, New Zealand, in Australia, the Aborigines still fight for that recognition. They've got it. They were given it by the high court of the country, and then it was that decision of 10 years ago, which ended the fiction that it was an empty land that they existed. They're still struggling to be recognized, land rights, and a whole health problems, education problems, and so on.
You've written about the Sydney Olympics, and also for the world, that might have been the first time they learned about the Australian Aborigines.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, the world's press arrived in Sydney, and, you know, there's only so much you can write about Olympic Games, and the more adventurous journalists actually asked some questions about who these strange black people were and what was their background. And the Aborigines have had a renaissance in one sense, and they've produced some extraordinary activists. And they told them, and they took them to places, and they showed them the condition of Aboriginal people, but they tried to explain the often insidious assault on the Aboriginal struggle by the government of, well, all governments have done it, but especially this very conservative government now in power in Australia.
John Pilger is our guest, who has done an extraordinary number of films and written books, has won many awards for his work. Again, I keep coming back to the fact that his name is not very well known in the United States, and let's talk about that. Okay. Let's talk about Cambodia. You did a number of films on Cambodia and almost got them shown in the United States, well, at least one of them.
Well, the first film I made in Cambodia, which was right at the end, it was about the whole Pol Pot regime, and mine was the first documentary about Cambodia under Pol Pot, and it was called Year Zero, The Silent Death of Cambodia. And it told the story of what had happened under Pol Pot. It also told the story of, once Pol Pot had been overthrown by the Vietnamese, how the international community, i.e. the West, had refused to help the stricken people of Cambodia because their liberators had come from the wrong side of the Cold War, the Vietnamese. And, of course, we're only within a few years of the American defeat in Vietnam. So those very explosive politics were at work. And when I went to Cambodia, just after Pol Pot had fled and made this film, we arrived in Phnom Penh. It was virtually an empty city, and it was full of orphan children, and the streets were running in its surreal scenes of the streets running and with money, which were pouring out in the monsoon rains from the blown-up National Bank. And, you know, it was an apocalyptic sort of situation. And so it was a very timely and very important documentary. And it was shown made for British television and shown all over the world. I was interviewed by Peter Jennings on ABC television. I knew Jennings when he was in London. And they showed one clip of it because it was just had a great news value. So I decided, as you know, a lot of this film was about US policy, which was then driving the fact that the Cambodians were not getting any real Western help, a great revenge policy. This was the time that Ford and Kissinger were in power, just after Nixon. So it was a very important expression of U.S. foreign policy in Southeast Asia. So, in other words, I felt it was a film that ought to be seen in the United States. My director and I took it to Washington, to PBS, the national people there, showed it. I think they'd asked to see it, actually. I'd, in the meantime, been back and made a second film, Cambodia Year One. And so I had two films. We offered to cut these two films together for showing on PBS. We said we'd do it for nothing. It was just terribly important. It then went through a whole series of mirrors, mazes, and letters, and we'll get back to you kind of thing, you know. But I kept at them. Finally, PBS said, look, we're just not sure about the objectivity of your film, to be honest, so we're going to get in a journalistic adjudicator. It sounded really Orwellian, this, a journalistic adjudicator. But those were the words he used. And they selected a man called Richard Dudman, who was the correspondent of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the distinguished by the fact that he was the only American journalist that Pol Pot allowed into Cambodia during his rule, and came out and he wrote something about Pol Pot had instigated this extraordinary housing program or whatever. Meanwhile, Pol Pot was at work killing lots of people.
No people anyway, to live in the houses, no, but at least he's got exactly. Some nice houses.
But Dudman was nominated as the journalistic adjudicator of a film that was highly critical of Pol Pot and highly critical of U.S. policy. And Dudman turned his thumb down on the film, and it was never shown in the U.S. It's been shown in universities here and there, but and that's the same thing happened with my East Timor film.
But before we get to East Timor, it was shown once, wasn't it, on WNET?
Yes, it was a later film. I made five films in Cambodia, one called Cambodia the Betrayal, which examined the whole relationship between the Khmer Rouge, who were then in exile but very much supported by the U.S. against the Vietnamese-backed government in Cambodia. It was about that. It was about the U.S., the U.S.'s collaboration, if you like, with the remnants of the Pol Pot regime. That was shown on WNET in New York. Good for them. They followed it with one of those discussion programs that tries to take the sting out of it, but that didn't matter. It was shown. And just on the basis of that, it won an Emmy.
It won an Emmy.
It won an Emmy. So off I went to New York and received an Emmy at this glittering ceremony in the New York Hilton, when I've hardly any work shown in the United States on the basis of one showing in New York. And that must be, winning the Emmy must have done it, because not a film of mine is being shown. My films are distributed by a wonderful organization called Bullfrog Films in Pennsylvania. They get them round to the universities, colleges, to small groups.
But in terms of mass distribution and when they can make a difference, for example, like Death of a Nation, which is how I think I really came to know your work. It was an absolutely groundbreaking film on East Timor, and it says it all in the title, Death of a Nation.
It was, the full title was Death of a Nation, the Timor Conspiracy, and it was really about the conspiracy between the Ford-Kissinger administration and the Suharto regime to attack East Timor, to take it over, and for the U.S. to supply Suharto with the means to do so, all of which has now been confirmed by released files this year, 2002. We knew that before, of course, and we didn't need that to confirm it, but there it is. Now, that film, again, my director and I, we said, we're going to try this again. This film is about East Timor and the U.S. Let's go to the U.S. So I looked up my old colleague, Peter Jennings, at ABC, and had several telephone conversations with him. Didn't actually get to see him, but saw a producer of his who explained that, look, you've clearly got a terrific story here. How can we get Jennings into it? Can we get him in there? And I said, well, you may be able to, but we filmed this in secret, and it took about a year to organize, and I'm in it. Here's the film. Why don't you show it the way it is? And this was a film that, when it went out in the UK, had people calling at the rate of 4,000 calls a minute.
John Pilger, author of The New Rulers of the World and filmmaker of dozens of films that have been seen around the world, not very much in the United States. When we come back, we'll look at whether the public space is shrinking with John Pilger. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to the conclusion of this interview with filmmaker and author John Pilger.
Where are your films airing in the UK?
They air on the main commercial channel, ITV, which is the opposition to the BBC. They don't go out too early. I've had some go out at 9 o'clock. They go out at 10:30, but that's because of the commercial constraints, that more popular programs go out earlier. I'm not saying it is...
So there's, you're saying there's more of a space in Britain
for
this dissent. I mean, you're attacking British policy
all the time. Yeah, I attack it all the time. Yeah.
You talk about the Anglo-American policy and
same
everything
thing.
From Iraq to Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, Blair is just a sort of, you know, he's a kind of minor apparatchik in the whole American project. And I'm known for attacking them. But there are different traditions at work in Britain. I'm very careful in, I don't want to compare favorably that which is certainly under threat, and television in Britain is under threat from monopoly, and from the stripping of regulation by the Blair government. One of the things that has kept television at a reasonably high standard level in Britain has been regulation, that the commercial companies for which I've made my documentaries have had to put out documentaries, have had to put out current affairs. And the British public over the years...
They have to because it's...
It's part of the regulations. But those are being taken away. And so on the ITV network, there's very little left. I'm left and one or two others. But that great tradition of documentaries on mainstream television in Britain is being undermined. But compared with the US, it's night and day. I mean, I remember there was a program on Palestine on PBS here about 20 years ago. And it's the controversy is infamous. And it was a rather mild program, just trying to explain who the Palestinians were.
Well, we're talking about your movies. You've also written many books, among them Heroes, which you wrote back in 1986, and it's been republished now.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, you talk about going to Palestine 25
yeah.
years ago. Can you talk about why we didn't see this book here 25 years ago,
well,
or
I,
in 1986?
Well, I published. Could never have this confirmed, but it was published by a mainstream publisher, as all my books are in the UK, and offered up to a publisher in New York and accepted, as I understood it, although nothing was written down, and then nothing happened, and I inquired, and finally I was told by somebody inside that the chapter on Palestine had so offended a couple of important people within this publisher that they turned their thumbs down on it. Now, I don't know, I can't vouch for that being the absolute truth. That's why I'm not going to name the publisher. But it certainly wasn't published after it was accepted. Anyway, that's history. Now, that was 1986. This year, 2002, was published by Southend Press in Boston.
An independent press.
An independent press.
But that part, the chapters on Palestine, talk specifically about what you think was most objected to, what you had done in Palestine then, with your trip with a Palestinian.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a very much a... It was about taking a Palestinian back to his home. And it was a very... It's a chapter very sympathetic to Israelis who I felt were ignorant at that stage of the suffering of Palestinians. It was quite a gentle view. I don't think I'd take that view now. I'm less tolerant of them now.
Well, what do you mean taking him home? Where was he?
He was in a refugee camp in Jordan, and I took him across, when you could in those days, I took him across the Allenby Bridge to near Jaffa, to where his house had been.
How did you get through the checkpoints? Were there checkpoints?
There wasn't. He was. You could talk your way through in those days. He was. I think the story was that he was assisting me in my research and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And we found this house where he lived, and we knocked on the door, and there was somebody who had been given his house.
It was his house,
the man I was with,
and
a Palestinian. And inside there was an immigrant, very nice man, who was really distressed by this meeting, the former owner. He said, I didn't know. He said, I thought you were dead. And he wanted to invite us in, but Palestinian didn't want to go in, and so on. It was just very telling. But in no way did it cast the Israelis or anybody in the stereotypical way. It simply, through the use of a kind of microcosm, told, I think, a wider truth. But such is the level of propaganda about Palestine and Israel that even a gentle story like that then, and I'm sure it would probably be still true today, is considered offensive.
Yeah, you were in Israel when 50,000 people marched against Israeli government policy.
Just about a month ago, 50,000 Israelis rallied in Tel Aviv to demand that Israel end its illegal occupation of Palestine. Now, I worked it out. If that had been in the UK, it was the equivalent of about 600,000 people. In a small country like Israel, that's quite something, 50,000 people. I'm not saying that in any way are they a majority. On the contrary, I think that views have hardened in Israel. There's a siege mentality. And the suicide bombings have certainly enhanced that siege mentality, that fear, understandably in many ways. But all the same, there is still a sizable minority in that country that is just fed up with having to endure the obvious. And the obvious is, until Israel ends its occupation of 22% of original Palestine and allows the Palestinians to get on and live normal lives, they won't live normal lives. The logic of it is just incandescent to me, but there you are.
I know that your voice is beginning to give out, and I don't want to push it anymore, but I just have two other questions. Yeah. And one is, where you come from, why you continue, why you persist, and do you feel that the public discourse is, the space is shrinking? But first, what motivates you as you go from one country to another, from East Timor to Cambodia to Iraq to Palestine to Afghanistan, etc.?
Well, it's up to others to say what motivates me. I mean, I've always regarded being a journalist as a great privilege. It allows me to go into people's lives, and they tell me stories. It's very simple, really. I don't think I started out with any sense of mission or anything like that whatsoever. I just wanted to be a journalist. And I followed, in terms of how I regard journalism, as the best stories. But the best stories are about human beings, and they're about justice and injustice. And those who try to separate journalism from humanity create something else. It's not journalism. Yes, you can have academic discourse. Or you can have the voice of governments, the voice of other vested interests. But journalism should be the voice of people. And a friend of mine who's a distinguished American journalist, Martha Gellhorn, wrote a book called The View from the Ground. And her philosophy was that journalists should report from the ground up, not through the other end of the telescope, looking down from power. I don't know. I grew up in a very political household where we were all for the underdog, and that's helped too. But it's about people, really.
In fact, you write about that in your book, Heroes: The Introduction, the background, and how your family. Well, what your father, grandfather. Exiled from Britain.
Well, no, on my mother's side, my great great grandfather was an Irish convict who was sent to Australia in chains. When the War of Independence happened in the U.S., Britain had nowhere to dump the Irish and the poor, and who they regarded generally as criminals. So Australia then became a penal colony, and my great-great-grandfather was one of those, and he was sent there on the charge of uttering unlawful oaths. So he was a man trying to survive who spoke out of turn. But on my father's side are Germans, there's a similar thing. My father was a member of the Australian branch of the International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, which began here, of course. And although he regarded almost everything American with suspicion, he had a very powerful view of the American, almost a forgotten chapter in American history, because he was a member, he was an Australian Wobbly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ours was one of those rare households in Australia where we did speak about politics, not too deep.
And your mother and grandmother?
My mother was a political person, in a more gentle way, but she was a very passionate woman who stood up for underdogs and got herself into trouble doing that. This produced a very uncertain family, as all families are, even though they pretend to be different. But I'm grateful to them for what they gave me.
Hmm. Finally, as we look at the world today with the expanded war on terrorism, mm-hmm. With the U.S., as you were saying, the unopposed superpower, do you think there's more or less hope when you look at the grassroots movements on the ground and their strength?
I think there's great hope. I think hope's a problematical word, but I think because we mustn't just hope. However, I think there is the prospects are very good as far as I'm concerned when I look at the strength of the internationalist movement. We should stop calling it the anti-globalization. It's the internationalist movement. It began in the developing world with mass movements like the Landless Peoples Movement in Brazil. It has spread throughout the world. It has been helped enormously by technology. There's no doubt about that. I think I get the feeling is the U.S. Is waking again. There's a stirring here again. This is the country that produced, you know, some of the great movements for human rights in history. Voices like yourself have refused to be silenced. And I just don't believe these people can get away with what they're getting away with. This gang in Washington and their various allies around the world and in Britain. I just think human beings are too interesting. The public intelligence is too critical to accept this all the time. They accept it in the beginning, maybe. But after a while, people have just... people are too political, even instinctively political, to accept it. And I take a generally optimistic view, even when others wouldn't.
Well, John Polger, I want to thank you very much, ending with the words of the woman you quoted, Martha Gellhorn. What makes John Polger a truly great journalist is his conscience and bravery. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
John Polger, that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. John Polger has twice won Britain's journalism's highest award, Journalist of the Year, as well France's Reporter Sans Frontières and an American Emmy Award in it. And if you'd like to go to our website, it's democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. He has just returned from the occupied territories. His film is coming out in a few weeks called Palestine is Still the Issue. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Michael Yeh. Anthony Reparation Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
We are all together. See how they run like pigs from a gun. See how they fly. I'm crying. Sitting on a corner for late. Shirts, stupid blooded Tuesday man, you've been a naughty boy, you're
let your face grow long. I am the Eggman. They are the Eggman. I am a walrus. Coo-coo-coo-doo. Mr. City Policeman sitting pretty little policeman in a row. See how the fly.